This morning, we are in Hebrews 11. We're going back to verses 17 through 19. We spent last Sunday in verse 17, but we're going to take in the entire paragraph here about Abraham, verses 17, 18, and 19, and I'm going to read those. If you want to turn there and follow along and keep your Bible open to this page for the duration of the lesson. Verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called, concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. In the long history of human worship, there has never been a request God made of anyone that's even close to what we are reading about here in this text. There's never been anything like this. God asked Abraham to offer to him his only begotten son, Isaac. Now, to set this in a context that we can work with, let's think about the concept of Abraham of sacrifice for just a bit. Basically, sacrifice is the idea of man giving something to God. Blessing is God giving something to us. But when we sacrifice, when we offer sacrifice in our worship to God, we are giving something back to Him. And not just anything. We're not at liberty to give just anything that we want. In the very first instance of worship in the Bible, Genesis chapter 4, there were two brothers who worshiped. One's worship was accepted. The other's worship was not accepted because one of them gave God something God didn't want. One gave God what God had asked for, a blood sacrifice, an animal sacrifice. The other brought some food out of his garden or out of his orchard and offered to God. God did not accept it. So we're not at liberty to give God just anything we want. Worship is to be in spirit and in truth, according to the truth that God's revealed. But within the set of things that God will accept as worship, we're to be giving Him our very best. I want you to turn back in Hebrews chapter 7. There is a very interesting story here about Abraham coming across a man by the name of Melchizedek. Melchizedek is sort of a mysterious figure. He appears on the scene back in the book of Genesis, chapter 14, I believe, and then he disappears until we're told that God is going to raise up a priest after the order of Melchizedek, and then he disappears until Hebrews chapter 7 here, where the writer makes a point about him. And the point that is being made is that Abraham gave his best to this man. Now, let me read verses 1 through 4 of Hebrews 7. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being translated King of Righteousness, and then also King of Salem, meaning King of Peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, without neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. Now consider how great this man was, to whom even the patriarch Abraham gave a tenth of the spoils. Now this Melchizedek was both priest and king. King of Salem, which later we knew as Jerusalem, but priest of the Most High God. And when Abraham is returning from rescuing his nephew Lot, who had been carried off by Chedorlaomer and some other kings when Lot lived in Sodom, Abraham crosses paths with Melchizedek. For Abraham to go back to his home down in Hebron, he would have gone right by Jerusalem, and maybe that's where this meeting occurred. And when Abraham met up with Melchizedek, Abraham recognized that this man is greater than I. He holds a higher rank than I do. Now that had to be a pretty high rank considering that Abraham is called the father of the faithful. But when the father of the faithful met up with Melchizedek, Abraham gave him a tenth of everything he had recovered in the rescue of Lot. And not just that, but verse 4 says that he gave him a tenth of the spoils. The Greek word translated spoils is the word Akron. Have you heard of Akron, Ohio? That's the word that's used here. And the word Akron means the very best. It means the top. When the Gentiles had engaged in battle and won a victory and collected the spoils, they would pile all of the spoils up with the very best of what they had captured at the top, and they gave a tenth of that to their gods. That's what Abraham did. He not only acknowledged Melchizedek's greatness by paying a tithe, giving a tenth of everything to Melchizedek, but he gave, that tenth came from the very best. He gave of the gold and the silver and the jewels, not of the ratty gym shoes that he probably recovered at that time as well. And so, worship involves giving something to God. It involves giving the best we have to give to God of the things He's willing to accept from us. We are giving Him the best. When we sing, singing is called a sacrifice in the book of Hebrews. We give you ought to be singing the best that you can possibly sing. Singing is not a time for Christians to be silent. It's a time for worship, for sacrifice. And it's not a time for mumbling or singing distractedly. It's a time for singing the very best you're capable of singing. That may not be very good. It's not in my case. But in singing, we're to sing the best we know how to sing. That's what God's expecting of us. So, sacrifice is giving something back to God. But somewhere along the line, men got the idea, not only should they give back to God for the blessings He had given them, they should give back to God because they're sinners. They are transgressors. And something is owed God for the fact that we have sinned against Him. And so men would bring food. They would bring gold and silver. And then they would bring animals. And in all of those kinds of sacrifices that they offered, they knew, men instinctively knew, we're not really giving our best, because there's one thing better than writing a check to somebody, as good as that may be, and that's in putting yourself at their disposal. Giving not something materialistic, but something personal. The highest sacrifices are the sacrifices of personality, where we're giving life back, not something intangible, but something living. But what men were doing, instead of giving themselves, giving their life, they were grabbing somebody else and offering that somebody else to the gods. And whomever they grabbed to offer was someone they thought was morally upright. They didn't get the criminals on death row out of the jail to offer to their gods. No, they would go get a young virgin. Or even more, they would offer their own innocent children. The Old Testament is filled with examples of men offering children as sacrifice, and God abhorred that, and God condemned that, and because of that kind of sacrifice of innocent life, God judged those nations. That's what sacrifice is, giving something to God, with the highest thing that we can give being ourselves. And then that's what creates the problem here in talking about Abraham. There in verse 17, Hebrews 11, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, God is testing Abraham. And last week, from verse 17, we talked about the nature of the test from two standpoints. Number one, from what God asked. God asked Abraham to give the very thing that God condemned other nations for giving. Children. God didn't ask for just any old child of Abraham. He asked for the child of promise. Not Ishmael. I want Isaac. The one I promised to give you, that you didn't wait for, but I gave you anyway. The one through whom the Messiah is going to come. The one you love more than anyone else. That's the child I want you to give back to me in sacrifice. And that had to cause a lot of confusion for Abraham. Lord, you're asking me to give back to you that which you condemn in other nations when they offer a child to you? So that was the nature of the test, the timing of the test. Genesis 22 verse 1 says that it was after these things that God tested Abraham. And after these things means after God had promised him that you're going to have a child, a son, there's going to be a great nation come from you. I'm going to give them all this land that you see here. And from one of your descendants is going to come the one, Jesus Christ, who's going to bless all people. After God had made those promises to Abraham, he turns right around and asks for Abraham to give back to him one of the things he had given in promise to Abraham, namely that child of promise. I want you to sacrifice Isaac. And so we're going to finish talking about this today. Talk a little bit more about Abraham's test and get through verses 18 and 19. So let's first talk again about what it was that God asked. He asked for Isaac to be sacrificed. And in that, it seemed to everybody that God was contradicting himself. And this put Abraham in a dilemma. If Isaac's the one through whom these great blessings are going to come, what's going to happen to all of those blessings you've promised, Lord, if I kill my son, if I make him a sacrifice? What about everything else that you promised? Whenever God sends us a test, the devil shows up. And the devil showed up in the Garden of Eden when God said, you can eat of every tree in this garden except one. And that prohibition became a test for Adam and Eve, and the devil showed up and began whispering in Eve's ear. And you've got to know that the devil was whispering in Abraham's ear during all this time. What in the world is God doing asking you to give your son back to him? That's not like him. He's condemned other nations that have done that very thing, and now he's asking you to do that. There's something wrong. He's not thinking straight. He's not himself. I bet the devil was whispering that. I bet the devil was whispering something like, what is this going to do to your marriage? You take Sarah's child and kill him? What's that going to do to your marriage? I bet he asked something like that. Or he may have said what he said to Eve. He said, yes, God may have asked you to sacrifice your son. He may have told you not to eat of this tree, but he didn't mean it. He doesn't mean it. Now, for whatever reason he asked you to do that, he doesn't mean it. Any test that God sends us is not just God testing us. Be sure the devil is going to jump in on that. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7, Paul talks about how he was given a thorn in the flesh. And the text makes clear whatever that thorn in the flesh was, it was given him by God. It was given him by God to keep him from being proud and arrogant. The thorn was given Paul by God to offset the great blessings Paul had been given. God allowed Paul to see heaven. And God knows what the devil would try to do with that. And so to keep Paul humble, to offset the work of the devil, there was given him this thorn in the flesh, which Paul refers to as a messenger of Satan to buffet me. Anytime God deems it necessary to test us, the devil is going to try to show up, and he's going to try to turn that test to his own advantage. So Abraham's being tested here. And the test boils down to whether you can trust God or not. And let's talk about how Abraham responded to the test and how that interrelates with whether he trusted God or not. Number one, Abraham's response to God's requirement was instant. He didn't put it off. He didn't argue with God about it. He didn't even tell Sarah about it. I mean, why tell her when he already has clear marching instructions from God? God had told him what he wanted so clearly, so truly and realistically that there was no doubt in Abraham's mind, but what this is what God wants. And that being the case, Genesis 22 tells us he got up early. He had to make a 3-day journey to where he was going to offer Isaac. The mountains of Moriah. Moriah was the mountain on which the temple was later built. And he got up early and set off under full assurance, full conviction that he was doing God's will. That's something that faith does. Faith removes all the riddles for us. I mean, Abraham's probably thinking in his head, well, how in the world can Isaac fulfill God's promise if I kill Isaac? Who would not be thinking that? And that kind of thinking is enough to stop some people dead in their tracks. I can't go through with this until I know how this is going to turn out. I've said before, most of us want to know the back end at the front end. We want to know how something we're being asked to do is going to turn out before we embark on it. That's not the way faith acts. When God called him out of Ur, Abraham didn't say, well, tell me how it's going to be when I get down in Canaan, and maybe then I'll leave Ur. No, he just left because that's how faith reacts. Faith works by love. Faith is obedient. Abraham got up early and set out to obey God. And I think as Abraham was making that trip, that journey, he was doing what faith does. The very first verse of Hebrews 11 says, faith enables us to see the future. Abraham didn't know how God was going to do it. He trusted that God would work it all out. And he was looking for something beyond the temporal blessing of just having a son. Let me say that again. Abraham, as much as he loved Isaac, was looking for something beyond the blessing of just having a son. Now, we've already read about this back up in verse 13, 14, 15, 16, they who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. Abraham was looking for something superior to, better than, living in Canaan with Isaac. Verse 16, he desired something better, a heavenly. He didn't understand how it was all going to work out, but he believed by faith that this was going to work to his heavenly blessing. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17 says that our temporary light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. What God asks of us may not turn out well in this life, but we're looking for something beyond this life. Abraham loved Isaac. But he loved God more. Parents, walking by faith means you're going to love God more than you love your children. And parents need to hear that because in our day and age, What most people do is make their child their little god, that their entire life is built around. And whatever that child wants, that child gets, and everything is lined up to serve the whims and the wants of that child. And that child becomes a little deity in the family. And because of that, the true deity's instruction is sometimes overlooked. And parents will rebel against God's instruction, especially in the area of discipline. They'll just rebel against what God says about raising up a child, disciplining a child, because they think they know better than God what their child needs. Let me tell you something else. Not only do you need to love God more than you love your children, God loves your children more than you do. And because He loves your children more than you, and because He perfectly loves them, because He made them and knows what they need, what He has said in His Word for raising children is what you need to be committed to and listen to. And Abraham, if nothing else, loved God more than he loved that special child, Isaac. And he was obedient to the will of God. Now look at verse 18. Of whom it was said, we're talking about the child that Abraham offered, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Now there was the dilemma that Abraham's struggling with. When I was 100 years old, God gave me this child. And now he's asking me to give this child back to him as a burnt offering, as a sacrifice. And so we brought wood, we brought fire, and I'm to kill my son. I'm not only to offer him, I'm to execute him. So verse 18 defines Abraham's dilemma. Verse 19 tells us how he handled it, concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. Abraham thought God was going to resurrect his son. He was going to kill Isaac, but God was going to resurrect his son. Where did he ever get an idea like that? A lot of Bible scholars will try to convince you that the Old Testament people were pretty ignorant about death and life hereafter and heaven and such things, and I don't think those scholars have done a very good job of reading their Bible. Here Abraham believed that God would resurrect his son. Where did that idea come from? Well, to see where it came from, all we have to do is back up to verse 12 in this chapter. Here's what verse 12 says. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky and multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. You know why Abraham had no problem believing that God would resurrect his son from the dead? That's where he got Isaac from in the first place. He got him from the dead. From the deadness of his procreative powers, from the deadness of his wife's procreative powers, God brought forth life. Abraham's thinking, if God can do that once, he can surely do it again. Now, he was wrong in that. His opinion was wrong, but that didn't matter to God. What mattered to God is that this man had enough trust in him, enough confidence in him, enough loyalty in him, that he offered in his intent, in his mind, in his purpose, Isaac was as good as dead. And it's spoken of in the past tense. He offered his son Isaac. That's what mattered to God. And that's when God said, God, in the nick of time, the angel stops Abraham's hand from completing the deed. And God says, now I know. Now God knew before. But sometimes God lets things play out so that we'll know that Abraham truly feared him. And in what he did, Abraham reenacted what God himself would do. And there again is the mystery that we cannot explain. After prohibiting child sacrifice, after stopping Abraham from following through with the child sacrifice, after condemning nations that engaged in it, what did God do for our salvation? He sacrificed His child. The Gospels tell us in Matthew 27, verse 2, that the Jews delivered Jesus to Pilate. The Gospels tell us, Matthew 27, verse 26, that Pilate delivered Jesus to be crucified. But Peter in Acts chapter 2 takes that same word and in verse 23 speaks of Christ who was delivered according to the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. The ultimate truth of the New Testament is that it was God who put Jesus on a cross. Christ told Pilate, "You couldn't do anything to me except what God's allowing you to do." God was the one who put His Son on the cross. He did the very thing He tells everybody else, "You better not do this." But He did it. And that solved all of the problem. Somehow or other, that solved all of the problem. And look at verse 19. The very last phrase. From which He also received Him in a figurative sense. Not only was Isaac figuratively offered, he was figuratively resurrected. They're played out there in the hills of Moriah. The sacrifice and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Abraham's faith was equal to the task. And he, the father of the faithful, becomes the example, the great example of what God is expecting from us. By faith, Abraham sacrificed his son. By faith, he was given his son back by God.